This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. We're almost a year into ubiquitous school closings as a response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And even with a vaccine being rolled out, it is far from clear when most students will be going back to full-time in-person classes. How are the shutdowns affecting K-12 education and changing the way we think about public schools? To answer these questions, I talked with Corey DeAngelis, the Reason Foundation's Director of School Choice. He says that a historically large number of parents are leaving traditional public schools and looking to take their education dollars with them. As student failure rates climb and virtually no one is happy with the way virtual education is going, DeAngelis tells me there's also mounting frustration with teachers' unions for their continued opposition to reopening, despite mounting evidence that schools are not a significant source of infection. If there's a silver lining in any of this, it's that there's a growing recognition that traditional education funding is deeply flawed and that money needs to follow individual students rather than simply go to schools or systems that seem indifferent at best and purely self-interested at worst. Over a dozen state legislatures are considering laws that would massively expand publicly funded school choice, and DeAngelis says that the pandemic may accomplish what decades of white papers have failed to deliver, a switch to a system in which parents, rather than bureaucrats, decide where their kids go to school. Here is the Reason interview with Corey DeAngelis. Corey DeAngelis, thanks for talking.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So let's get right to it. What is the big takeaway regarding school choice and the last year, basically, of COVID-inspired lockdowns of schools?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are figuring out that there's no good reason to fund institutions when we can fund students directly instead. And one of the biggest themes that have emerged here is the difference in the response to the pandemic from the private sector, with private schools and daycares and restaurants and grocery stores fighting all along to reopen, or they had been reopened for a while. You even had places like in Kentucky where the private schools were fighting against the government to try to reopen, and they took the fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. You had places like in Ohio and Michigan where private schools were doing the same kind of fighting. You had places like in Sacramento where the private schools, some private schools were rebranding themselves as daycare centers to get around ridiculous regulations that were keeping them closed.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that for a second? Like, how is it that daycare centers would be allowed to be open, but not schools?
Learning's dangerous, Nick. Don't you know? If you're in the same place, but if you're learning, that's when the virus can actually spread. Mm-hmm. That's sarcastic, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, there isn't much of a difference. And so this is why people like the private schools, I think it was a Catholic school in Sacramento, when they saw this ridiculous regulation that was allowing daycares but not schools, they rebranded themselves. They retrained all of their teachers and their employees as daycare employees to get around the regulation. And
it's really kind of a response, or it shows how powerful teachers' unions were, essentially, that they were able to prevent schools from reopening. Because I mean, that's one of the big lessons here too, right? That teachers' unions, certainly in the larger school districts in the country, places like Chicago, New York, and LA, were pretty much dead set against reopening.
Yeah, and this doesn't mean that the people in the teachers' unions or in the public sector are evil, that they have any bad intentions. It's just that there's a messed up set of incentives that's baked into the K-12 public school system, where they get your money regardless of whether they open their doors for business. So this is the first kind of lesson here, is that the private sector had one set of incentives, so they fought to reopen. The public sector in so many places, and the teachers' unions in so many places, had an incentive to keep their doors closed. So they fought for that. And there are 4 studies on this topic. I know because I did the first one with Christos Makridis over at MIT. And each of these 4 studies have found that places that have stronger teachers unions, even after controlling for a ton of different characteristics in the local areas, were much less likely to reopen for in-person instruction. And it really didn't take a lot of studies for people to realize this, because people have been seeing the negotiations and conversations with people like Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York City, where he was talking to the union leaders to keep the schools closed based on certain low positivity rates of 3% a couple of months ago.
How dangerous was it to reopen, or how dangerous has it been to open elementary schools and high schools?
Not very dangerous, especially if you look at the lower grades, such as elementary schools. And I mean, regardless of looking at the evidence, which I'll get into it in a second, just look at the private sector. Why was it okay for the public sector employees to go shop at grocery stores that have tons of different people coming and going all the time? And then why was it okay for the private schools to reopen, but not the public schools? This is why I think it has more to do with power and politics than actual safety, just seeing the differences in the response from the different sectors. And then another thing that was crazy was that the public schools in some places were saying that we can't open for in-person instruction because it's too dangerous. But then they were reopening the same physical school buildings for in-person childcare activities. Mm-hmm. And this really confused me at first. This is one of the strangest things that happened over the last year. A lot of districts were doing this all across the country. But what I found out was that the public schools were not reopening their doors for in-person instruction, and the employees in the public sector were staying home and working from home to provide virtual instruction, whereas employees from the private sector were coming in from places like YMCA and other private providers, and they were more than happy to provide those services to families, which was great for the private sector. They got to make extra money. It was great for the public school employees because they got to stay home and got to continue receiving their paycheck, but it wasn't very great for families because they had to pay twice. They had to pay through the property tax system for the public school employees, and then they had to pay out of pocket for the childcare activities, which they would have been getting any other year except for this year. So it was essentially a form of extortion on the part of the public school system.
If the kind of refusal to reopen schools was one of the worst outcomes of the past year of lockdowns, what are a couple of other of the worst responses in your mind from the education establishment in the face of COVID-19?
Yeah, when this all started, right at the beginning, when schools were closing in March of 2020, one of the first things that started happening was that a lot of families were figuring out that the public schools, at least the traditional public schools, weren't doing a good job with the remote learning. They weren't providing the service at all, or in some places it just wasn't working out really well technologically speaking, and the rollout just wasn't really good, especially at first. And so families start to look at things like virtual public charter schools, which are also free taxpayer-funded schools that in any other year you would have been able to switch to these schools. But the establishment figured that out, and they started to realize that they could lose a lot of money associated with families switching from one public school to another to a virtual charter school. And so you had places like in Oregon where the Oregon Education Association lobbied to the government to make it illegal for families to switch to schools in this time of need, which I think that's just absolutely ridiculous. Wow. For them to come out and protect themselves at the time where the families were the most vulnerable. And you saw similar actions in places like California and Pennsylvania, where they didn't get everything they wanted. They didn't actually make it illegal to switch to virtual charter schools, but in places like California and Pennsylvania, it was technically legal to do so, but the money wouldn't follow the child to the charter school. So you had so many families that their students were already admitted to the charter schools. But when this rule went down in these states, the charters were forced essentially to put those families and children back on the wait list, which again, this was an act that protected the monopoly at the expense of thousands of families.
And charters, generally speaking, I realize it varies from state to state or district to district, but what percentage of the funding given to traditional schools do charters tend to get?
Yeah, my latest study on this out of the University of Arkansas with my co-author Patrick J. Wolf and a couple of other co-authors, Larry D. Maloney and J.F. May, we found that across 18 different metropolitan areas, the charter schools actually received only about two-thirds of the per pupil funding as the traditional public schools, which really doesn't make any sense in the first place. Why should a student be valued less or punished just because the school that they happen to be residentially assigned to didn't work for them? So it does happen to be the case that these virtual charters and the brick and mortar charters tend to get, it's not always the case, but tend to get less funding than their traditional counterparts.
What are other really bad responses from the educational establishment that you've been tracking over the past year?
Another one of the big themes that arose was that there was a lot of, you know, it was one thing just to push for the schools to remain closed and then the call for more funding for reopening the schools and for more staffing and other things that benefit the teachers unions. But then they started lumping in all of these political demands in their calls to reopen schools. So for example, one of the first teachers unions to do this was the Los Angeles Teachers Union, where they actually called to ban their competition. They wanted to ban public charter schools. They wanted to defund the police. They wanted Medicare for all and all of these other political goals that didn't seem like they had a lot to do with the reopening of schools. Yet those demands were included in their report on quote unquote safely reopening schools. You also had several teachers unions band together with the Democratic Socialists of America and other groups all across the country. They've had two of these already within the past year. Their National Day of Resistance, they called it, where they did call for more money for federal investment to reopen schools, but they also called for all these other political things. And in the most recent time that they called for this, they called for things like canceling rent and foreclosures and other things that were tangentially or non-related to safely reopening schools.
Do you think, were there any unions that were pushing to reopen schools, or, and if not unions, groups of teachers in various places?
I didn't see teachers unions calling to reopen schools, but there was an initiative by some teachers started in New York State. It might have been New York City, but they have a group called for Teachers for Reopening Schools. I don't remember the exact name. That might be it, but you'll have to go check it out. But teachers sharing videos about how they think schools should reopen. And these kind of calls were much different than the union calls, which were calling for tons of more money and all of these political demands as well.
Before we get to the kind of positive developments over the past year that have come out as a result of the lockdowns, can we talk a little bit about the effect of virtual learning on students, or the way that it was done? Is there a consensus or an understanding of were students getting an equivalent education, or how bad is the situation from a kind of education point of view?
Yeah, all of the districts that we've seen data coming out, and this doesn't mean that remote learning doesn't work for anybody. It could work for a lot of students, especially if it's rolled out in the right way. But the way that it's been rolled out from so many of the public school districts is that failure rates have been increasing by a lot. So for example, in my area, Fairfax County Public Schools, the rate of students who have been failing two or more classes has increased by 83% since last year. There's been a nationwide study on this by McKinsey and Company, and they've estimated that students have lost between 1 and 3 months of education this year. And they've seen that there have been inequities as well for disadvantaged groups of students. They've lost more months of learning than more advantaged groups of students. So this could be leading to inequities as well. But we've seen other individual school districts like Houston Public Schools and St. Paul, Minnesota Public Schools coming out with these data, all suggesting that the failure rates have gone up.
What explains that? Is it that because this was done kind of, last minute, it was unplanned for the most part, that teachers weren't really prepared to do it, and students weren't receptive to that kind of learning? Why was virtual learning, and anecdotally, everybody I've talked to, I know virtually no one who will say that their kids are happier or doing better under virtual learning. But why is it so ineffective?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that. One could just be the regulations and the slow to adapt, structure of the K through 12 public school behemoth. And it might just still be trying to work on doing it a better way. So it might just be that, but it could also be that for particular students, that in-person instruction just works better for them, that it's easier to be engaged with the teacher, particularly for lower grades of students, elementary school students in particular. Maybe they're more likely to be interested in the teacher in person, more likely to pay attention in person. So that's a couple of the reasons as to why this isn't working for so many students.
Is there a sense of, when you talk about students might have lost 1 to 3 months of education, what does that mean? Is this the type, what is the likely ramification of that? Is that something that is going, how big a drop off is that? And then is that going to be remediated the minute that schools reopen? Or is that something that has just gone for good?
Well, it's hard to tell, but Washington Post came out with an article on going over this study, calling it a lost generation, is the title of the, I believe it was an opinion piece by the Washington Post. It's hard to tell whether it's how big these losses will be for individual students, but there's also a study in JAMA that estimates the amount, the number of lives lost associated with getting worse educational attainment, because people who have lower educational attainment tend to live shorter lives. They did this peer-reviewed evaluation estimating that there will be millions of lives lost associated with the learning losses from the school closures and the failure for so many schools to reopen in person.
Well, let's talk about the best or most promising responses. What have you seen? What are the bright spots, if any? Where schools, sometimes disruption, it's never welcome, but sometimes it has positive effects. What are good things that you've seen develop over the past year related to school choice?
Well, people are figuring out that the way we fund K through 12 education just doesn't make any sense at all. It made sense to people like me all along, because I've always believed that the money should follow the child to wherever they're getting an education. And that made sense to a lot of people, particularly when their schools were failing to educate their children year after year, decade after decade. But it's another conversation altogether for the schools to not even reopen their doors and then to leave families scrambling in some places at the 11th hour, emailing them right before they're supposed to send their children back to in-person instruction, telling them, well, you know what? We had a staffing problem. There was a sick out in our district, so we're not actually going to reopen the school. So families were really getting the short end of the stick this year. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that. And they're seeing that these closed buildings are continuing to get their children's education dollars while they're scrambling, and none of that money's following them to pay for private school tuition and fees out of pocket or to help cover the costs associated with home-based education. And because of that, there have been two recent surveys at the national level finding that there is more support for funding students as opposed to institutions. Mm-hmm. For example, a Real Clear Opinion research poll recently found that since April, there's been a 10 percentage point jump in support for funding students directly, from 67% to 77%. And then the latest poll by EdChoice found that 81% of the general public and 86% of families now support the concept of education savings accounts, or what I like to call funding students as opposed to systems.
Yeah. What about the movement towards, either charter schools, private schools, homeschooling? It's hard to know what the long-term effects are going to be, but are there public opinion data, or are there actual bodies moving into these kinds of situations over the past year?
Yeah, so there's a good amount of data, like I talked about with the surveys, with people supporting all types of school choice. The EdChoice poll, for example, they looked at charters, vouchers, tax credit scholarships, and education savings accounts. And since last year, all of those have gone up by a lot at the national level. But there are people voting with their feet as well to the private school sector and to virtual charter schools in particular. And in the public school sector, the latest national survey from Gallup estimates that traditional public schools will lose about 7 percentage points of their student population this school year. So it seems to be a mass exodus from the traditional public school system, which has been slow to adapt and which has been more likely to fight to keep their doors closed. And in particular states, there have been some data released. I believe the latest one that I've seen is from South Carolina, where the enrollment in the private schools has gone up by about 2 to 3%, whereas the public school enrollment has dropped by about 1 to 2%.
What, could you talk about how schools actually get funded? Because in general, it's, I mean, you're right that regardless of whether the schools are open or closed, they're getting a certain amount of money from, the state and local school districts and things like that. But it does matter, right? Ultimately, if they have fewer students, they're going to receive less money.
Yep. Although schools do get to keep a lot of the funding for students they no longer educate whenever a student switches to a charter school or switches to a private school, it is true that there is a significant amount of funding that is determined based on the number of students you enroll. So what this means is, since there is a mass exodus from the public school system this year, there's going to be millions and millions, if not billions of dollars lost in the traditional public schools. And in this sense, it might be that the teachers' unions kind of overplayed their hands. And in the short run, you could argue that it kind of made sense for them to keep their doors closed, because just from a short run cost benefit decision making standpoint, they figured, well, we'll keep our salaries, we'll keep our benefits, and we'll reduce our costs associated with any risk, and then also work duties with in-person instruction and commute times to work and things of that nature. But then if you start thinking about the long-term effects of this, if people continue to pull their students out of a system that they feel isn't working for them, if they don't return, this could have ramifications for the K through 12 public school monopoly that they might not have considered at first.
Right. What about at the state level? You've been tracking some states that seem to be rethinking, the way that they fund K through 12 education, the public funding of it. Who is doing things that are, that are particularly interesting?
Yeah, I think I've been tracking about 14 states now this year in January that have had legislators introduce bills to fund students as opposed to systems. So states like New Hampshire, Utah has a particular bill that's interesting. Arizona has a bill to expand their already existing school choice program. You have Nebraska, you have Iowa. Florida has a bill to restructure all of their vouchers, which can only be used at private schools for tuition and fees, to restructure those as education savings accounts to allow you to use them at private schools, but then also for home-based education, for micro schools, for pandemic pods, for any government-approved education expenditure. Just today, Kansas and Kentucky, I just found out that bills were released in those states as well. And most of these are education savings accounts bills, where the money follows the child to an education savings account, and then it could be used for any government-approved education expenditure.
So an education savings account means that, say, the state says we're going to give everybody, every student who's in a K through 12 grade, we're going to give them, $5,000 or $10,000. It goes into a special account, and then parents can use that to purchase goods or services that are somehow affiliated with their kids' education.
Yep, absolutely. And you couldn't use the money on non-education expenditures. So some people have issues with that. When they first hear about this, they might say, oh, well, what if they spend on X, Y, or Z? Well, that's not allowed with these types of programs. But
they can buy a private school tuition, even if it's a religious school with
that? Yep. You can use it for private school, religious tuition at a private religious school. And in fact, if you don't allow for families to use that money at a religious institution, that's considered unconstitutional, especially with the latest Espinoza decision, because that would infringe on families' First Amendment right to freely exercise their religion. And there's also an argument to be made that that would be a 14th Amendment violation by discriminating against religious families and religious institutions just because they're religious. So, and the reason that this is not a separation of church and state issue to allow this funding to follow the child to religious education is the same reason why the Pell Grant and certain pre-K programs do not violate the Establishment Clause. And the reason for that is because the families are and the students are the primary beneficiaries, and they have a choice in the matter to take that money to a public to the public school if they want, or they could take it to the private religious or non-religious school.
Of the arguments of creating more competition in K through 12, whether it's within, private schools and private alternatives or charter schools that are publicly funded, et cetera, is that markets adjust to shifts in demand and supply much more quickly. Has that been happening? Have charter schools or virtual schools or private schools, have they been able to handle the rush of new interest and enrollments, or are they struggling to keep up?
It depends on the particular school and the particular location, but from the sense that I can see is that there are upticks in a lot of places, and I haven't heard complaints from the charter and private school sector. I think they're more than happy to serve additional customers and expand. And they tend to have fewer regulations, which allow them to adapt to these kind of changes better than the traditional public school system. One of the arguments is that the traditional public school system is a monopoly that doesn't have an incentive to do a good job. But even if you did have an incentive to do a good job in the traditional system, another problem is all of the bureaucracy and red tape that ties the hands of benevolent actors.
Mm-hmm. One of the functions of schools has nothing to do directly with education, but it has to do with things like sports and clubs, whether we're talking about music clubs or drama clubs, et cetera. What has been going on there? Has that just kind of disappeared from K through 12 age students' lives, or, are schools still trying to do stuff like that, and does that matter, or is that just kind of inessential to the, core of education?
Well, it depends on the district. There are some places that allow for sports but not in-person instruction. There are other places that allow one and not the other. There are some places that close both of them, some that have both open. And there's actually a good database from MCH Data, if anybody wants to go look it up. They actually surveyed over 10,000 public school districts across the country, and they asked the districts if they're open for in-person instruction. Are mm-hmm. they remote? Are they doing sports in person? So it really depends.
Yeah. What is the, are there school, I'm speaking to you from California. I live in New York City, where there has essentially been very little or no in-person instruction for any length of time over the past year. But what's going on? I mean, what percentage of students are doing full-time in-person instruction? What are doing only virtual? What are doing a hybrid?
Yeah. If you look at a recent piece that came out by Axios, they put some of the data together, and they reported that only about 5% of private schools nationwide were doing fully remote learning, whereas the traditional or the public school sector in general, about 62% of those students were doing fully remote learning. And then also in your area, I found some data myself out of San Diego County. Not exactly by you, but in California. Mm-hmm. And I crunched the numbers there, and they reported for almost all the private schools and the public schools, about 90% of them in the county. And I compared it across sectors and found that about 55% of the students were in person for the private school sector, but for the public school sector is only about 2%. And I even controlled for differences in compared schools within the same zip code, compared different schools with similar enrollment counts and other controls as well, and still found that the private schools were just much, much more likely to be in person.
You have in the past highlighted kind of political hypocrisy on the issue of private school versus public school or choice. You discovered that Elizabeth Warren had been stretching the truth, to put it mildly, that she had sent her kids to public schools when in fact she had sent them to private schools, or, you know, for various lengths of time. A big story that came out over the past year was Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who presides over the state of California in Sacramento, where almost all of the schools were in total lockdown and everything was being done virtually, but he was sending his kids to an in-person private school. Is political hypocrisy, like, has that been a particularly, has this been a particularly bad season for that type of stuff? And what's the likely effect on the way that voters or people who are sending their kids, have school-age kids, respond to politics?
Well, I think you hit the big one, which was Gavin Newsom, who had his child in in-person instruction at a private school. But then another one was in Alexandria City Public Schools. The superintendent last year had his two children in the traditional public school system. But then this year, after supporting the closure of schools for in-person instruction in his own district, he actually pulled one of his children out and put them into an in-person private school. So that's just another example of this hypocrisy that people didn't like very much. And another form of hypocrisy came from the teachers' unions, where, for example, there was a leader in the Chicago Teachers Union, it was one of their board members, was tweeting up a storm against reopening the schools for in-person instruction. But then some people found out that she was tweeting that from the beach in Puerto Rico. So a lot of people saw that as hypocritical because they were saying, well, if it's safe enough to do in-person vacation, why isn't it safe enough to do in-person work within Chicago in the public school system? So there was a lot of backlash around that. And I think I've said this before, but I think this is really a good moment. One of the only silver linings of all of this is that people are realizing that this K through 12 public education system has a lot of flaws, and it can't adapt to the needs of every single individual student, even if they're trying their best. And families are seeing that there's no good reason to fund the institutions when you can fund the students directly. And so I think that's the one of the main takeaways here, that support for school choice is rising. Who knows, 2021 could be the year of school choice. We're seeing all of these bills being proposed in various states. In just a couple of weeks, we've already seen at least 14 of them in different states.
So, well, let's talk about the federal role in education policy. As a starting point, we'll have you summarize what kind of grade Donald Trump, the outgoing president, deserves for his education policy, and also your feelings about Joe Biden and his administration coming in a second. But, you know, just as a general backgrounder, what do you think is the proper role of the federal government when it comes to K through 12 education?
There isn't. The word education is not in the Constitution. So there shouldn't be a federal role in K through 12 education. It should be up to the state.
Okay, so you believe that the federal government should not be sending any money for school or school related activities?
No, they shouldn't. The reality is, even though it's not constitutional, they still do that. So I would prefer if they're going to be involved, if they are going to send funding to the states, I would rather that funding go to individual students instead of government school buildings.
Right. And that is, that's your general mantra, which is that to the extent that education is being publicly funded, it should always go to individual students rather than to schools, buildings, school districts, educational establishments.
And what's interesting to me is a lot of the people that support funding students directly when it comes to other levels of education, if you think about Pell Grants and GI Bill or the Head Start program when it comes to pre-K, they get all up in arms when it comes to K through 12 education in the in-between years. And the only difference there is one of power dynamics, that choice is the norm when it comes to higher education and pre-K, but choice threatens a K through 12 entrenched monopoly when it comes to the in-between year. So you get a different power dynamic and the fight is a lot different, but it is logically inconsistent right to support these other levels of funding
and it's
directly than opposed
it's
to.
B- bizarre as well, because K through 12 education is mandatory. I mean, like you get put in jail if you don't send your kids to those schools, but you not only have to do it, you don't get a choice. So maybe there's some, you know, kind of continuity there, but it is very strange. Let's talk about Donald Trump first. Donald Trump did not cover himself with glory. And, you know, after he lost the election, he is now, you know, I don't know what he's doing since he can't tweet or anything. How would you summarize, how was he as an education president? Was he good, bad, or indifferent?
He was good on school choice. You got to give him that. He supported mm-hmm. funding students as opposed to institutions. So he had it. He hit the nail on the head when it came to K through 12 education policy as it relates to school choice.
Did he actually put into place policies that did that? I mean, that was his rhetoric, but did he deliver on that?
No, and some might argue that it's kind of good when the president actually isn't enacting a bunch of stuff at the federal level, since it should be relegated to the state and local level anyway. But he did use the bully pulpit very effectively when it came to K through 12 education and school choice. And it kind of helped spark more of a national conversation about school choice. And another thing he did was appointed Betsy DeVos, who's a longtime advocate of funding students as opposed to institutions or school choice. And that further had more and more people talking about school choice. Of course, you had some people arguing against it. But the reality is, if you don't have people talking about it at all, you're stuck with the status quo. So I'd rather have people arguing about the policy and talking about the costs and the benefits of the policy, which, to be clear, most of the things associated with the policy are benefits for every member in society, except for the establishment and the teachers union. But if you talk about an idea that really doesn't have any good arguments against it, I think truth will win in the end. So I think that's a step forward.
Okay. What about Joe Biden? He, you know, are you hopeful or worried about his Department of Education?
Well, I don't expect them to be proposing the School Choice Now Act or supporting that type of legislation at the federal level. I don't see them supporting Rand Paul's School Act, for example. But
what would Rand Paul School Act?
The proposal was to reallocate nearly all existing federal education dollars from buildings to students. So Title I funding and the majority of K through 12 education funding at the federal level.
What is, can you ballpark how much, I believe that on average, K through 12 schools spend somewhere around $14,000, $15,000 per student. You know, that's averaged over the country, so it varies widely. But out of that, what percentage is coming out of the federal?
Yeah, we spend about $15,000 per child per year. You nailed it on the head there. And the federal funding is only about 7 to 8% of the total. So we're talking about a small percentage, but you know, some things that the Biden administration could do to harm school choice is, one, they've been talking about defunding charter schools based on particular things that they want the charter schools to do. For example, they talked about Biden's national policy director, Steph Feldman, for example, in an interview with Education Writers Association, said that they were going to take federal funding away, or that they were planning on taking federal funding away from charter schools that, quote unquote, don't provide results. When asked about what they meant by that, they didn't really have an answer. But then later on in the interview, when asked about, well, what about the traditional schools that don't provide results? Then the conversation was all about, oh, those schools don't have enough resources. They just need more money. And so in the same interview, they kind of admitted, you know, that they want to reward the traditional schools that fail, but then take away all the funding from the charter schools that may or may not actually be failing. They wanted to take away funding from for-profit charter schools, which I don't have a problem with for-profit charter schools. I don't have a problem from an institution making a profit from voluntary activity and selections. What I do have a problem with is when a certain monopoly gets your money, regardless of how satisfied you are with that product and regardless of your choice. And that is more reflective of the traditional public school system than charter schools. And then also, they said they were going to take away federal funding, or planning on doing this, of charter schools that didn't have a quote unquote democratically elected school board, as if that actually leads to higher quality and accountability. The only true form of accountability is from the bottom up, from allowing families to vote with their feet to the institution that works best for them.
In a year's time, how will we know if school choice, if the school choice movement broadly defined, how will we know if it's doing better or worse?
Well, we'll see how many students are using or have access to private school choice initiatives. It looks like a good outlook by seeing how many bills are being introduced in several different states across the country. But ultimately, those things need to pass in order for students to actually get access to these types of programs. So we can look at the percentage of students who are using these programs over time. And while private school choice has seen progress in the last couple of decades, it's still true that only like less than 0.5% of the school-age population is actually using a private school choice program. And we can also look at the number of programs that pass, but I think the better metric is how many students have access to these types of initiatives that fund students instead of systems.
Long-term trends, the school choice movement, the modern school choice movement kind of dates itself from Milton Friedman's 1955 journal article where he talks about kind of vouchers as we discuss them. You know, benchmark it from 1955 to now, is school choice winning? Is it losing? Is it coasting? What's your summary of school choice?
I think it's winning, but it should be winning a lot more. The first modern day private school choice program wasn't until 1990 in Milwaukee. And then you had the first charter school law in 1991 in Minnesota. But since then, we've had more and more families using private school choice initiatives. For example, I talked about it earlier. You went from essentially 0% to around up to 1% of the school age population using private school choice initiatives. We have about over 60 private school choice programs. So we've added more and more programs, but they've mostly been targeted in scope. And I think the way forward is to allow everybody to have access to these programs. Don't have these particular eligibility cutoffs, because what we've seen in the movement is that while they have grown over time, they haven't grown as much as I would like to see over three decades of time since 1990. The charter school movement has seen larger growth. About 45 states in the District of Columbia have a charter school law on the books, and about 6% of the school-age population is currently enrolled in a public charter school in the United States. But these more recent bills that we're seeing in different states, some of them are more universal to allow for more students to have access to these programs. And I think that's the way forward. I think more and more people are understanding that everybody should have access. Perhaps you have some more money for less advantaged students so that you can still fight for equity. But at the same time, the success of these programs is, they're more likely to be successful if you have more people who get access to the benefit. And if you have more families fighting to keep these types of programs in place.
As a final question, a final point, why does K through 12 education matter that much? Why is it so important?
Well, because we're compelled to send our children to K through 12 public education settings. And for a lot of families, they may not be able to afford to cover the cost of home-based education or for private alternatives. And so this is one of the biggest reasons why school choice is so important. We're funding the students directly is so that more families can have access to alternative options like home-based education and private education, private schooling at least. And so, I think that's why it's super important for reform to the K-12 education system.
Do you think, given large majorities of people in favor of more robust forms of school choice, is education policy conceivably one of the places where Americans are not as polarized as they are in other kinds of political issues?
Yeah, if you look at support for school choice, at least, there's majority support based on tons of different backgrounds. A lot of surveys have found recently that there have been majority support by Republicans and Democrats alike. But when you start looking at how the elected officials vote, it just so turns out to be, even though it shouldn't be a partisan issue, the Democrats are much, much less likely to actually vote for these types of policies, even though their constituents for the most part, support these policies. And I think the union politics has a lot to do with that.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Corey DeAngelis of Reason Foundation, thanks for talking.
Hey, thanks so much, Nick.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.